the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
This morning, a busy morning, we speak with local resident and book author Dr. Tom Schwenk, who was a physician here in Park City in the 70s and 80s and moved away, then moved back. His new book, it's a historical fiction. It's called Beyond the False Summit. It looks at Park City's history through the eyes of one female and one male physician in the late 1800s.
Then members of the Park City Walkability Committee from 2009 look back at how walkability and bikeability took shape and how there's more to be done to create at least one final safe connection.
And finally, Gina Cox and Sonia Nordstrom of Great Basin Canine Search and Rescue in Camas join to talk about the organization, and they ask for your help to vote. There's just one day left so they can win a Land Rover Defender to haul those dogs around in. That all coming up this hour on The Mountain Life. Our next guest is Dr. Thomas Schwenk. He's a board-certified family physician who practiced for 6 years in Park City, starting way back in 1978 before he embarked on an academic career. Initially, he was alone here as a physician, the only one at the clinic, and this was following the closing of the mines. Dr. Schwenk joins the show now to introduce his new book. It's a historical fiction called Beyond the False Summit. It explores how medical science in the 1890s and the barriers facing women physicians, we love that topic, and then the great Park City fire of 1898 all come together in the story of mining corruption and medical tragedies. And we're so happy that Dr. Schwenk could join us here in the studio. Good morning to you. Welcome.
Good morning. I'm happy to be here.
Well, we were talking in the green room about how we think this may be the only historical fiction written about Park City. What are your thoughts on that?
It's possible. I can't say for sure. We know that there is a lot of nonfiction, a lot of great history, some of the great names who've documented Park City history. And I thought it would be fun to take it in another direction with a storyline that incorporated several themes, of which Park City history itself is the dominant one. But medical history of that era was incredibly exciting. There was a huge transformation in how medicine was practiced from the mid-1800s into the early 1900s. And then my personal interest in the role of women physicians, because that was another great theme, again, from the mid-1800s into the 1900s. And so those three came together in a very fun way, I think.
Absolutely. Well, you highlight these two physicians, Drs. Sarah Fletcher and Thomas Wilson. They come, obviously, one's a female, one's a male, and they come from very different backgrounds. Why did you settle on these characters? And we must know about that last name, Fletcher, because that's a famous one.
That certainly has a history in Park City, and those who've been here for a while will know that name. And I think the issue for me was seeing how a male physician comes from a very troubled, very tragic background, leads to a loss of confidence, a lack of self-confidence, but as a male physician has many advantages, many privileges, comes into town and establishes a practice. Sarah Fletcher, on the other hand, comes from a very learned and comfortable family, great educational opportunities, top in her class in medical school, but has all sorts of barriers as a female. And so those two sort of cross over, and each sort of helps the other in their own way.
Wonderful. How did your own background as a physician inform the writing of this book?
Well, that's what's fun, I think. I mean, you can read a lot of medical fiction written by non-medical people, and it can be quite good, I think. I've gotten a lot of feedback from readers that the medical scenes are really frightful and really gruesome and really difficult at times, and I have a feeling that's because I've been there. And I've done that. I mean, some of the surgical procedures I've done many times, obstetrical deliveries, a lot of the medical care is very personal to me. And some of the mining scenes actually come from my experience here practicing, as well as some out of the park record archives. But I think that the medical history can be particularly powerful if you know it professionally.
I'm sure. It made me think a little bit about Dr. Quinn, Medicine Woman. Remember that show back in the day?
I do.
What kind of, looking back at that period, what kind of medical changes did you find are the most radically dramatic improvements since those days?
So in the early 1800s, mid-1800s, there were all sorts of very, now we think, very strange theories about illness and disease. Magnetic theories and humoral theories and various very odd kinds of notions about how disease came to be. And then in the mid-1800s and then on into the late 1800s, infectious disease theories, germ theory, the idea that there were vectors of germs that caused disease. And that then led to notions about antisepsis and the radical notion of washing your hands, which plays a role in the book with a physician doing an obstetrical delivery. And those really advanced, but of course, like all paradigm shifts, there were some physicians who discounted those notions. The same thing with anesthesia. So ether was discovered and came into use sort of mid-1800s, some in the Civil War. But again, older physicians kind of discounted the need. Some surgeons actually believed that pain during surgical procedures was important for the healing process.
Oh, good Lord.
And, and that somehow, you know, strengthened your character in some fashion. But it also, the lack of anesthesia was why, for example, amputations were famous for their brevity. The general standard for an amputation during the Civil War was 45 seconds. And there's a good reason for that if you have no anesthesia. That's right.
Absolutely.
So anesthesia came along, antisepsis came along, and then germ theory came along, and that led to the issue of diphtheria. Diphtheria was just a raging disease that just wiped out whole families. There's a cluster of tombstones in the city cemetery of 5 of 6 children in one family here died in a week from diphtheria, if you can imagine that.
Oh, goodness.
And that kind of finds its way into the book a little bit as well. But there was a notion by scientists that you could infect animals who would create an antitoxin, what we would think of as an antibody, to diphtheria. Take the serum from that animal, inject it into children, and that would neutralize the disease at a certain stage. And that theory came along again in the late 1800s, and there is a record in the park record of a physician in Park City who used that in the late 1890s. And so that kind of informed the book as well. The research was initially done in smaller animals, and then they realized there was not enough blood, so then they went to horses. And it turns out horses develop a mild illness, but not serious. And then you harvest the blood from the horse, separate the serum, inject the serum, and it saved children's lives.
So it worked. It did work.
Oh, it absolutely worked.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, there was a whole.
I was on the edge of my seat. I was too.
There was a whole business in place with horses that were famous for being infected over and over and over again and donating blood over and over and over again. Mm. And that kind of finds its way in as well. So there were a lot of interesting forces that converged in the late 1800s that I found compelling.
Yeah. If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're speaking with Dr. Tom Schwenk. He practiced medicine here in Park City in the late 70s, early 80s. He moved away. He Well, we will find out about when he became a writer. He moved back part-time in 2003 and then, or 2005, and then full-time to Park City in 2021. And he has written this book, Beyond the False Summit. Well, let's talk a little bit about your writing. You were a family practice physician turned writer. Is this a retirement thing, or have you always loved writing?
Always loved writing. I've just always enjoyed writing. When I was in college, actually, my college aptitude tests said I should be an English professor. and I then went into an academic career after practicing here, and it had a lot of publications, a lot of scientific publications, but also a few more personal essays and editorials, and that sort of whetted my appetite. But as I approached retirement, the last 10 years of my career, I was dean of the medical school at the University of Nevada, and as I approached the end of that, I knew from taking care of lots of patients who retired that I had to retire to something, not from something. Yes. And so I started thinking, well, what do I like to do? And writing sort of came back, and then my fascination with Park City history intersected with that. When I practiced here, I took care of some of the aging miners who had worked the mines in the early 1900s. And I took care of patients up Daly Canyon, for example, who lived in some of the little mining shacks up there and made house calls. And
those little $6 million mining shacks.
And now $6 million shacks, that's right. And was really fascinated by their experiences. One comment that one of those miners made to me was picked up in the book, because it had to do with silicosis and all the miners who died of silicosis. And this patient told me that he could tell something was wrong with miners who went down into the mines and then developed lung disease and died at a very early age. And he said, I decided to get out. So he asked to be moved up to the surface as a lift operator, took a pay cut, I think from $3.50 a day to $3 a day, took a 50 cent a day pay cut. But he lived because he knew that something bad was happening. So I was filled with all these stories, and in my naive way, I thought, well, I can write a novel. And then the adventure begins. Because I got in touch through friends. Kevin McCarthy put me in touch with Katie Mullally, who has a great publishing business in town, Surrogate Press. And Katie's fabulous, has a great operation with Amazon contracting, Library of Congress registration, ISBN number, the whole show. But I said, Katie, I really need a coach. I said, I know how to write. I mean, it's not a copy editing punctuation issue so much. It's you know, a writing coach. And she put me in touch with Stacy Domalski, who has Park City history. And along the way, also put me in touch with Michelle Reinhold, who has the cosmic design, graphic design business, and did the cover for me. So all of this great expertise in Park City,
right here in Park City,
kind of converged. But Stacy will tell you, if you ever talk to her, that I started behind the starting line, shall we say. There were probably 10 drafts and edits and comments before I even got to what is kind of a respectable point, and then moved forward with, I think, more respectable writing.
And yes, if you're listening to this interview and you're wondering, Katie Mullally, is that the same Katie Mullally who's the co-host of Cool Science Radio? Yes, indeed, it
Multifaceted.
That's right.
It's
kind of how we've rolled here in Park City.
Absolutely.
Well, we don't have a lot of time left, and I feel like we could talk to you for hours about this, but one of the big topics is the Great Fire in Park City, the 1898 fire here, and that's brought into the story. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, and it feeds into the title a little bit. Many people have asked me about the title, and the title has to do with the fact that many plot lines seem to lead to a conclusion, but then there's one more step. And that's kind of what the fire is about, because many observers at the time thought that the Great Fire of 1888 was the conclusion for Park City. Most mining towns in that era never recovered. They all were burned, and most did not recover. And Park City did. And so there's that next step where Park City survived and then thrived after the fire. But as I say somewhere in the book, the preface, I think that people see Park City now and see Main Street, which is incredibly cute and incredibly quaint and very nostalgic, but that's post-fire. Mm-hmm. All of that was gone. And so all of the historic brick buildings are post-fire. There are a few original buildings left before the fire, but very few. And it's just, it's a devastating disease.
Yes, indeed. There's one other mention of corruption among the mining executives. Did that really happen?
I don't know exactly.
I bet it did.
But I guarantee you, I mean, if you read much of the history at all kinds of lawsuits, all kinds of corruption. And so all of that general overview sort of found its way into this one character. And to the marshal as well. But I can't say that those are exactly the characters that were involved, but I'm quite sure there was a lot of that.
Well, what a great effort you've put forth. The cover, by the way, is beautiful. The book is Beyond the False Summit. Our guest is Dr. Tom Schwenk, a recovering physician turned writer. And this is really fun. So thank you so much for joining us. I know I asked you about whether or not you'll be doing a book signing at Dolly's, and they thought maybe after the Main Street construction. So look for Tom at Dolly's somewhere around the holidays, maybe.
Yeah,
and in the meantime, where do you get the book?
It's at Dolly's in the Western Fiction section. A museum has a nice display, and it's on Amazon.
Excellent. Tom,
thanks so
thank
much.
You so much.
Oh,
thanks.
A lot of fun. Thank you.
In 2007, voters in Park City approved a $15 million bond to fund walk and bikeability in the Park City area. A committee was formed in 2008 to recommend projects. Two people who were on that committee, former Park City Council member Alex Petwinski and Carolyn Murray, join us in the studio to talk about one remaining recommended project from 15 years ago that was never done, although there was money to do it. And they asked for the community's help in bringing this item back to help see its initiation and completion. That's a final connection across Kearns Boulevard that they're talking about, connecting Snow Creek area with Old Town area. Alex and Carolyn, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Okay, well, you too. Why don't we start off with this, Alex? Give us the history of the projects that were on this list that have been completed so far.
I would say the major projects that we completed and are really proud of are the Holiday Ranch Loop Road. We narrowed because it was basically a raceway, put a sidewalk along the side of it, and then continued that sidewalk along Lilacade all the way to Treasure Mountain and McPolin schools, so the kids would have a safe way to get to school. It's interesting that our whole plan was safe connectivity for people to bike and walk throughout Park City. Two major successes were the tunnels at Comstock and at the rail trail, both of which were very, people were skeptical of at the time, but you can't go 2 minutes without seeing somebody go through there. I would say those are the biggest. Carolyn, I don't know, do you have another one that you would like to mention in particular?
Well, I think that one of the elements of, like, for instance, Holiday Ranch Loop, it's not just a sidewalk, it's a pathway, and it's intended for multi-use, walkers, strollers, skateboarders, bicyclists, whatever. And it really has changed the whole feeling of people being able to move about in that neighborhood. The same with Comstock. If you look at Comstock, there are now crossings at each of the intersections. Kids can now, you would, back in 2005 and 6 when we started initiating this grassroots effort to get this bond as a referendum, kids were really at risk crossing that Kearns Boulevard area. Now you look around and you go to McPolin and the whole place is filled with bicycles. You drive through any of our neighborhoods in Prospector and in Park Meadows, you see e-bikes in the driveways with two-seaters, for little kids in the back. You see tag-alongs. You see, go to the high school now. You'll see stacks of e-bikes that are lined up there. So not only has the whole transformation of walkability, bikeability, sort of, you know, hit the, it's hit the big time here in Park City. But this last little effort to connect these areas, these neighborhoods, this is it. It's the tunnel, and it was about to happen. And for whatever reasons, new council, you know, there were, let's look at it from different perspectives. Let's look at a Hawk Beacon. Let's, you know, step back and look at all these different ideas to not do a tunnel. Well, we're kind of at the point where, Alex, you and I, before we die, we want to see the tunnel.
And, I hope not.
And,
well, maybe
and when
going.
This discussion started, you were actually young.
We were young. We were.
So to give our listeners a real mind's eye view, first of all, Alex, when you mentioned a tunnel at the end of the rail trail, this is that tunnel that if you're coming down Poison Creek Pathway by City Park, you cross under Bonanza and onto the rail trail. So I just wanted to mention that if people are wondering. Now, there are already, you mentioned the Comstock tunnel for schoolgoers,
right.
And then there has, since that whole walkability committee list of projects, there has been a second tunnel under Kearns, and this was completed within the last 5 years, that allows people, high school kids, to go under to the seminary who across Kearns and community. But those two tunnels are largely frequented by locals, right? Schoolgoers and things like that. Now, this tunnel that you are talking about would connect what they used to call Dance to Jans. It's not Dance anymore. It's Park City Market. So there's not that great alliteration there.
Some people don't even know what that means.
Right. And Jans is still there, of course. But basically, like Mary Beth said in the intro, this is sort of the north side of town with the whole rest of the south side of town, so Old Town to, you know, Park Meadows. Can you talk about why it's so important?
I think it's important for a lot of reasons. I mean, Carolyn and I are fortunate enough to be able to go from our homes to Main Street without crossing a major road. That's huge. I think it's also interesting that as we've developed, more and more people are using e-bikes, as Carolyn mentioned. And if you just stand at the corner of Kearns and Park on a Saturday afternoon for 2 hours. That's a long time to stand, but if you did that, you would be astonished at the number of people that ride across the road, walk across the road. And once again, this became topical for me last week when there was a car and bicycle incident in town on Park Ave. Now, it's not the same, and it wouldn't be the same situation. But when you look at the number of tourists, strangers we have in town crossing at that intersection, and again, this brings basically the corner by the Yarrow, which I'm not sure whether it's called anymore, Sheridan, Yarrow, by Vale, whatever.
Double Tree. Yeah. Which is going to change also.
There's a
plan before the Planning Commission right now,
which could help facilitate moving this along. But it connects that whole area to the north side, as Lynn mentioned, to the liquor store. People wanting to get from by bus to the liquor store have to cross at that intersection. And I think people coming along the Poison Creek Trail and heading out to Kimball Junction is a huge connection. All you have to do is just stand there, look at the number of e-bikes on the path going back and forth to Kimball Junction. Then it gets to this corner, which is incredibly dangerous, and it's just a matter of time, I think, until there's going to be a major incident there, and that would be unfortunate.
And I was going to say, if you do stand out there, stand well away from the street, because the speeds are incredibly fast. They're not 25 miles an hour. People are flying through that intersection. And, you know, the idea that this was initially one of the primary efforts on the part of the walk committee, the walkability committee that was put in place after the bond passed in 2007. That committee made the presentation to the council at the time. This was approved. It was going to happen. And money has been set aside. It is now millions of dollars were set aside for this project. It's not happened. It was going to happen, I don't know, a couple times and most recently in 2023 when there were earmarked funds set aside for it, and now we're just at an impasse again. And many of us, you know, are just sitting here wondering what happened. There's money in the bank for this project. We are going, we're risking walking away from grants from UDOT, which have been acquired. We are risking, I don't even know the financial implications of not spending that bond money that has been sitting there for 15, 16 years now. I don't know what that means because I'm not a financial person, but it's time to spend that money. And it's, you know, and if we have to do some more to raise or adjust our budgets or look at what happens, you know, with the balance of what it would cost to put that tunnel in, then we need to do that. That's our obligation as a city. But I do feel that this project is an obligation in so many ways to the community because it was a bond.
Well, it seems like it was a commitment that was made. It was accepted and acknowledged that this was a valuable thing. You touched on some of the reasons, and maybe it is truly unclear, but do you have any theories as to why it's been held up?
Well, there are several,
that you can say.
Well, there's some I can't, but there are also... You know, initially there were some major concerns about the infrastructure under that intersection. Somewhere along the way, there was talk about a roundabout there. And there were a bunch of infrastructure questions that kept coming up. But it kept coming back to, okay, let's just move the tunnel to the east a little bit. And that would solve a lot of the problems. And Carolyn referenced, there was a lot of money and may still be a lot of money available from the federal government, from the county transit fund, and other sources that amounted to just about paying for the whole project, probably two-thirds of it, which minimized the city's contribution. Those funds may go away, as Carolyn mentioned, and that would be tragic. I looked at it, my analogy is, okay, Alex, I have a house that I will sell you for $16 million, but you only have to give me seven, and what do you think? And I would leap on that in a heartbeat. I mean, no, everyone would. I mean, that's pretty much what this boils down to. And then there is always the change of council, the changing of priorities. Mm-hmm. And it just kept getting, you know, pushed aside. Not forgotten totally, but pushed aside. And here we are again. You know, last year, there was another, in April, actually, there was another presentation about it. And as Carolyn mentioned, they talked about surface connections, which... our transportation department doesn't even favor, you know, pedestrian islands in the middle of Kearns or Hawk Beacon.
That would be frightening. Yes. Pedestrian island.
Yeah. And Hawk Beacon is,
Hawk,
you know.
We know how those work. We had a Hawk Beacon at the high school crossing over into Prospector. That was it caused massive traffic jams. There are data out there that indicate how many hours of delay that impacted. Mm-hmm. I don't have it at the top of my head, but we could get it. All you have to do is contact, you know, transit department, and they'll give it to you. But that's why that tunnel went in. Hawk Beacon is not the answer. I've heard of things like a pedestrian scramble, which visually...
I'm just sorry, but the name of that really tells the story.
Which could be very amusing, but I don't know that that's the answer.
Well, I can't imagine that it's gotten cheaper to build these things since this has originally been accepted. So if we're able to move forward with this, is it even still feasible with the funds that are left? Or have those been invested in the meantime, or are they just sitting in a fund somewhere?
Well, the money is, the walkability money that's left is just in some form of interest-bearing investment. The city cannot, you know, really invest money in anything other than we would consider a money market or something along those lines. But I mentioned there are other sources of funds. The sewer district offered to kick in about $1 million, and I would think they're still interested in that. The costs go up every year. I mean, the latest estimate is anywhere around 16, 17 million. But remind everybody that a big chunk of that is already available, and it needs to be done. I mean, how can you put a dollar value on a potential disaster at that corner? And I sound like I'm overhyping it, but I think, you know, Lynn, Carolyn, and I live in that immediate area, and I travel it almost every day.
One child hit one pedestrian in a really rough situation.
Yeah, and that was the beginning of this project back in 2005 when so many parents got together and just were outraged at how dangerous it was to have our kids walk or bicycle to school.
Well, now, you know, the big thing that I see and everyone here sees on the roads now is this absolute explosion in popularity of e-bikes. And so, and also among our tourists, and there are more bikes all over, so we need to make more infrastructure for those bikes. Yes, as you said, Alex, I'm a Park Meadows resident, and full disclosure, I was at that city council meeting in April and expressed support for this project because I come out of, you know, I have to say the market is my market, and I come out of there almost every day and come on to Kearns, and I see the... You see people running across. It's dangerous in a car because
exactly, yes.
People do crazy things pulling out of there in a car to get out of there before, you know, whoever else is coming at 30 or 50 miles an hour. But there are some other things that council members suggested waiting for. One is the redevelopment of the Yarrow. The other one is, and KPCW just reported on this granting of an easement by Mark Fisher in the along the south side of Kearns, so on the side of the Boneyard and the Blind Dog, along that corridor. Now he's offering up an easement, yeah, at least of his property. Does that mean there's an easement all the way from 224 down to Bonanza on that side?
I'm not sure, but, well, city owns some of the property, so that won't be a big issue. Mark has already chipped in his piece. I would say that the developers of the Yarrow would be more than happy to contribute at least an easement into this. And Lynn, that was one of the other things that triggered this, let's bring it up again, Alex, idea, that that's going to be a big development. And the pedestrian safe walkway along the southern part of Kearns, this is the ideal time to design the tunnel so that it interacts with that pathway. And once again, there's a great opportunity to leverage on what the developer wants to do, what the city's goals are, and as well finish up a project that I think for both Carolyn and I, it's become a mission almost, that it's the last major piece of connectivity that the citizens voted for. I mean, this is not like we thought it up last week this is what we wanted to do.
So, quick question. Do you think it's more important to put this tunnel under Kearns before everything else is redeveloped? Or are you saying, and I think you have a call to action for the community that you ought to talk about in an upcoming meeting, that do you feel like it needs to happen before or after or what?
Now. It needs to happen now. I mean, it should have happened 2 years ago when it was initially redesigned. You know, engineers came in, finances were looked at, it was all set to go, and we got a new council and direction changed and emphasis and all these things happen. I understand that. However, this connectivity is essential, and it doesn't need to wait 5 years for the Yarrow to be redeveloped or for Bonanza to finally get done. It needs to happen now.
And we need to be proactive. I mean, you don't want to be following up on development, right? We want to be involved, being ahead of the curve, planning for what's going to happen, as opposed to, oh my goodness, we've created this situation that now we have to fix. Let's get ahead of the curve. Well, I mean, a couple of council members have been, let's fast track this. Let's get this moving. And when I say this, I mean some of the other projects. We need to fast track the tunnel as well.
And how is it that the public, if they also are behind this, what can they do to support the project or help it move forward?
Well, our call to action is a little gathering at Offset Beer.
Where is Offset Beer?
Oh, perfect. Gosh.
Generally.
It's right by the former Fairweather. Natural food store, right along Bonanza, very near the tunnel.
Yeah, right.
Very near the tunnel.
And behind Right at Home, Offset Brewery.
And our call to action is just if you want to see this move forward, or if you have really good reasons why it ought not to move forward, please come. And
when is it?
Oh, sorry, November the 2nd, which is Saturday, 4:00 in the afternoon. And we're just going to kind of gather and just talk about what our best next steps might be and how to, initiate getting some shovels in the ground on this and really finish off what the obligation was to begin with.
And I think both Carolyn and I will make ourselves available prior to that to be able to answer yes. people's questions, and contact info will be on the website yep. following our session today.
Okay. Can we publish your phone numbers on our
yes.
our post?
Absolutely.
Yes. Okay. Absolutely. Yeah,
okay,
be in touch.
We will do that. Mary Beth, do you have any final questions?
Well, I just wondered if, is there any obligation that you know of from the government, like from our city government, that if they have committed to this, like a time period?
I don't think there are time elements in a bond and when it's spent, but I do think that the money that had initially been allocated must be spent on walk pedestrian projects. I don't think it can be reallocated busing or,
And it's only gotten more important.
Well, it's got more important, and it's getting more and more expensive. And the longer we wait, the more it's going to cost. And it's kind of, I think, a fiduciary responsibility on the part of council to do it and get it taken care of, because that's what we want as a community. We said we wanted it. We passed a bond, 55% passed. Every open space and a trails bond that has passed since has been higher percentage passing. So these are the same things. People want this connection.
Alex Budwinski, former Park City Council member and Walk Committee member, along with Carolyn Murray of the Walk Committee. And you're on is it the continuation of the Walk Committee or something different? You're on a different
yes.
committee for
the
city.
So there's a bicycle ped plan that has just been, I think we've just wrapped up our final meeting on that. And the primary area of concern is this Kearns Boulevard and the crossing there. But much of our conversation was just basically, well, we can't do anything about that because council hasn't given the authorization to go ahead. But it was a project to identify the really hot spots and the areas that we need to connect our town. I'm also on the Neighborhoods First Committee, which is Neighborhood Streets First Committee. It's a little bit of a tongue tire. And that is, I am a resident representative on that committee. I'm the only resident on the committee. And I just welcome input about concerns on safety, issues to make your community neighborhood more walkable, friendly, livable.
Okay, the community meeting, November 2nd. That's Saturday at 4 p.m., November 2nd, at Offset Brewery in the Bonanza Park area. And Alex and Carolyn, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Well, Great Basin Canine Search and Rescue trains, I love this acronym, K9SAR, otherwise known as Doggy Search and Rescue Teams. And they certify them to the highest standards in order to provide these services at no charge to public safety organizations throughout the Intermountain West. Today, they join us, that is Gina Cox and Sonia Nordstrom, to tell us about the organization, but also to ask for your help, which is a vote for them before tomorrow. So they, like the Youth Sports Alliance last year that won that Land Rover Defender, so they too can join or win a Land Rover Defender to haul those cute dogs around in. Oh, and I forgot to mention that we have a little canine friend here, but Sonia and Gina, welcome to the Mountain Life. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And who is this little canine friend that I can barely see? A puppy.
This is one of our newest canine teammates. This is Tinkerbell, Tink for short. She and her sister Vika just joined our team. They are 20 weeks old. We select our puppies from a very young age. I think we first saw them about 8 weeks.
We saw them at six weeks.
6 weeks.
Picked them up at 8 weeks.
and, started vetting process. And she will hopefully be certifying in the next year and a half to so.
Great.
She's incredibly cute. If you could see her face.
It is a darn good thing, too, because she comes with lots of teeth as well.
Oh. Well,
they are fantastic.
If people aren't familiar with Great Basin Canine Search and Rescue, could you explain a little bit more about what you do?
Sure. We've been in existence since 2009, and we train not only the dog but the handler. I think a lot of people think it's just the dog part, but the handler has to have a lot of skills with regard to navigation and survival and the way odor behaves so that we can get our dogs into the mountains to source the odor. So there's a lot of handler part, fitness requirements and things like that. And then the dogs are our best tool. So the dogs really without a good handler are not particularly effective. Mm. And we do select a particular type of dog, pretty much the working dog. So we have a lot of the pointy-eared, German Shepherds, Belgian Malinois, Dutch Shepherd, that are from the working lines. And then we have the working line hunting dogs, as opposed to the fireplace, you know, Orvis catalog looking kind of dog, right? So, yeah, and it's a very lengthy process. It's not... It's throughout the lifetime of the dog. We do maintenance training weekly, and then we do training on our own. So it's not just you go to a training class, you finish, you certify, you constantly train. Wow. Hours and hours and hours and hours throughout the working life of the dog. Yeah. Much like a police dog, sure. Right? They go through their initial certification, and then they do their maintenance routine training.
And are you an independent organization, or do you work under the umbrella of some of the safety?
We're a 501c3.
Okay.
Purely volunteer. We have overhead expenses. We have some equipment expenses. The handlers really bear the brunt of it, I hate to say. But we will only respond at law enforcement request.
I see.
Or public safety organization request. As an example, what's going on back east, people are reaching out and saying, you know, are you going to come?
Oh.
We don't belong there. We don't have the infrastructure. We can't be self-sufficient for weeks at a time. We don't have our own veterinary staff. So there are different roles that the search dogs play. And like the avalanche dogs have a specific role. The disaster dogs have a specific role. We are more the wilderness side and also the law enforcement forensic side.
Just to follow that up a little, and what do you think are your most common situations in which you're called on for help?
I've been at this 30 years.
Wow. And thank you for your service.
That has really changed. I started back when we had a map and a compass and no GPSs and no pagers and no cell phones. With the advent of drones, SOS pagers, InReaches, spots,
peeps,
mm-hmm. It's really a lot more for the search and rescue teams. It's much more rescue than search. So we find that our calls are when it's for someone who's deceased, whether it's a crime or whether it's someone who has expired or gone off purposely.
Okay. We are speaking with Sonja Nordstrom, along with Gina Cox, and Tink. Well, we're not speaking with Tink, but Tink is here, this adorable little puppy who will be part of this canine search and rescue team. If you would like to help them out very much before tomorrow, when does the voting...
Today and tomorrow. Two days to vote.
Okay, by tomorrow at midnight?
Midnight. Okay. Eastern time, though, so 10 o'clock.
So you all remember the big campaign to vote for Youth Sports Alliance last year. They won the Land Rover Defender. Go to Great Basin's website now, which is Great Basin K-9SAR, as in search and rescue .org. And right there is the Defender Service Awards. It's the only honoree in Utah. So, yeah, we got to vote Utah here. We got to stick with, and especially this wonderful service that you're doing. What would you use the Land Rover Defender for?
Well, many things. So we offer several different services. Obviously, if law enforcement calls us out, we will go to site wherever they are asking for us to come. We offer, obviously, wilderness services. We offer water services to some degree. So we would be using that to take our boat to different places to practice and also deploy. We, as Sonja mentioned, we do regular interval trainings and seminars, so we could use that to help get to seminars. It just takes some of the edge off of our personal responsibility, right? It would just help us out a little bit. And then along with it, they also gear us up a little bit if we win and offer a cash prize as well. There are overhead costs to be a search and rescue organization, insurance, things of that nature. So
I would imagine huge costs. Where do you get your fundraising from now?
Well, it's a little difficult. We have been very fortunate that we've been getting matching funds from the Community Foundation of the Ogden Valley. So in this particular, we actually were finalists for this Land Rover the first year they did it in 2021. We were finalists in 2022. 2023, we said, I can't handle it. And then 2024, we're back in it. And that's the honoree category, is people that were prior finalists. So it's based on popular vote. So we do have, we rely solely on donation. And so the matching funds are very, very helpful. And we've been fortunate some of the local organizations here. But we have overhead, and to outfit a team, we don't fully outfit anybody, but we have a weatherproof team jacket, we have GPS, we have radio, we have things that we try to really equip that are the big ticket items, and it runs about $2,500 per team. And then, you know, I just got back from being on the road to a seminar, put 1,100 miles on my car. So it's, we bear a lot of personal expense, but we try to also pay for our members to attend specialized trainings that we can't simulate certain things.
Sure. I bet you can't put a number on the value that that would bring to someone's family if they were searching for a family member or a friend who had been gone missing in the wilderness. I can't imagine what that's like.
You can
answer
this.
It really is. And you know, we kind of get the funny look sometimes, right, when we say that we're out looking for deceased individuals. Like, why would you possibly want to do that? Obviously, everybody thinks of the idea of, I can't imagine what it would be like to not know and to be able to offer that closure. It actually goes beyond that. People don't understand that if you don't recover a person's body, you can't actually declare them deceased for a period of time. So if you think of even just the financial implications of that, and how that can become a hardship on a family, if you can't sell a house, if you can't sell a car, if you can't close out personal finances, there's a lot more to it than people sometimes realize. And so being able to help with that service, or if it's a case, if it's a cold case, I mean, it really is kind of impressive the work that law enforcement agencies, FBI, is doing. Sonia's also retired FBI, and so she has some of that background of the work that they do on that end, that then we can partner with them and just fill in that missing link with our tool.
Wow. So, thanks for pointing that out. That's a really interesting distinction.
In addition to bringing someone to justice.
Because
without the body, it's very difficult to make a case on a homicide.
Oh.
So we've been involved in some of those as well, right, that have been reasonably high-profile cases locally and out of state.
Oh, I'm so grateful for what you do.
Again, the website is Great Basin, the letter K, -9, SAR, searchandrescue.org. You can go and vote for them today and tomorrow to help them win that Land Rover Defender. But it's really nice to have you in to hear about this organization. Are there other canine rescue organizations in the Intermountain West? I mean, I know you go all over many different counties. We think of you in the Uintas because that seems to be where all of the, things go awry.
Yes, actually, there are two other primary volunteer organizations, one up more in, I guess, is it Davis County? Weber County, maybe, and then one sort of out toward Tooele, out of Salt Lake. Our members are from Salt Lake County, Weber County,
Summit County,
Park City. But
you're based in Camas, is that right?
Well, actually sort of co-based between Eden and Camas. We do most of our training up Mirror Lake Highway, which we'll have to see how that works out with the fire closures. But yeah, there are others. And then, of course, there's the FEMA teams that are out deploying right now, but that's under a totally different umbrella. And then, of course, there's the Wasatch Backcountry Rescue, the avalanche teams, which, yes, again, is a different entity and a different function.
Now, if you have a dog that you know is a breed that is good at this sort of thing, and you want to maybe become a part of that, still a little bit unclear on how that works.
Well, on our website, we have a how to get involved link, and it really articulates laboriously what it would take, and then we have an application process, and again, it goes to the human aspect as well, availability. I think people don't quite realize. I came into it thinking I was going to magically rescue the 7-year-old Boy Scout that gets lost in the woods. And then as we evolve in this, we realize the commitment and sort of this life, it becomes a lifestyle. It's sort of a second, very demanding, unpaid job.
Yeah.
That's expensive. It's
what we're all looking for in Park City.
But it is funny to watch people come in a normal car, and then they come with a truck, and then they come with the big crates, and all of a sudden they just kind of ramp up into what it becomes, right?
And it seems like we all start either as retirees or pre-having families, right? And then now, you know, I now have two children. We have another teammate that now has a child and is pregnant with another child. And so it has become, you know, the kids are out there working with the dogs. And it really is, though, I mean, a group of people. And we work with some of these other teams, and we test some of the same standards. We even have an opportunity sometimes to work with law enforcement. And I mean, we're all family when it comes to people that are working dogs, because we all understand what all goes into that and the bond and the relationship that's built with the dogs. It's not something you can really imagine, I think, until you really get in the thick of it.
Well, people in Park City certainly love their animals.
Yes,
and
they do.
If you respect and love your animal and you want to support the Great Basin Canine Search and Rescue, their goal of winning the Land Rover, which would be very, very helpful, it sounds like, to your organization, please vote right away. Everyone in Park City waits till the last minute anyway. So this is perfect timing to go to the site, click on their link, and give them a little love.
And you can vote every day. So today and tomorrow. And you can vote from different email addresses.
Yeah. And we're also on Instagram at GBK9SAR.
Yep.
And on Facebook at GBK9SAR. So
okay,
we've got the link everywhere. We're nagging people. It's a very difficult thing to do, but it's only for votes.
It's okay. They don't have to give money. It's just a vote. Okay, it does say here that your dogs are carefully selected from working line shepherds, retrievers, and hunting dogs.
Yes.
So perhaps my Oscar wouldn't qualify.
Oh.
Or perhaps I wouldn't qualify because I don't have emergency first aid. I have a lot of these other
things.
It's
a special breed of humans also.
Yeah. Do I have odor behavior?
I've never noticed that about you.
Do I have man tracking? Well, maybe. Wait, what is man tracking?
We can offer a class on that.
Yeah. Okay, well, Sonia and Gina, thank you so much for joining us today on The Mountain Life.
Thank
and best
you
of
so
luck.
Much. Thank you so much.